as we get started this evening, we will go into the flood and we'll get started right away. We'll begin with some scripture references from Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, we'll start with verse 5. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5, the Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil all the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and that his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind, whom I have created, from the face of the earth. Men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. So we see the beginning here of the flood chronology. We see the beginning of the flood as it occurred in Genesis. Now, as we go into this, and we're going to be taking a look at things, we see first off what was the reason for the flood. As we go through this, the first thing that we see was that there was a great wickedness in the earth. And I have read this portion of Scripture. Now, one of the things about this that we need to understand is that, first off, God was not totally surprised by the great wickedness that happened. It's not that God was standing up in heaven and it just totally shocked him when Adam and Eve sinned in the garden. And God says, oh my goodness, what am I going to do now? Now, I don't understand how God... Okay, I don't understand the responsibility of man and God's foreknowing all of these things. And I'm not smart enough to even try and understand this, but this fits into one of those categories. But we suffice us to say that God knew that this was going to happen. He knew what he was going to have to do with this. But we see that because of this great wickedness, this is one of the reasons why we had the flood. Another reason for the flood is because we also see that there were mockers and scoffers. Not only was there just out-and-out wickedness, but in 2 Peter chapter 3, verses 3 and 4, it tells us that, first of all, you must understand that in the last days scoffers will come, scoffing and following their own evil desires. They will say, where is this coming? He promised. Ever since our fathers died, everything goes on it has since the beginning of the creation. But they deliberately forgot that the long ago, by God's word, the heavens existed and the earth was formed out of water and by water. By these waters also the world of that time was deluged and destroyed. Man was not much different those days than he is nowadays. And we see the scoffing that takes place now as far as what is God going to do and the fact that God is going to have to punish sin. So we see that there were scoffers in that day that were going to be punished. We also see that there were individuals that were apathetic. We have Matthew chapter 24. And I realize that Matthew chapter 24 it's a tribulation time. But we see Matthew chapter 24, verses 37 and 39. As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be coming at the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. And so we see that the individuals before the flood had totally turned away from the information that they had through the creation that we studied this morning. They had all of this information. Adam and Eve had this information in the Garden of Eden, even more perfectly than we have now, because of the fact that their minds had not been scarred by sin. And they were able to understand all of these marvels so much better than we are able to see. But then we see also that the flood was not only a time of punishment and destruction of sin, of mankind for sin, but that it was also a vehicle of salvation. Now, this is one of the things, again, that it is difficult to understand. But the same Christ is a stepping stone for those who want to believe and a stumbling block to those who don't want to believe. And so we see this here, that the same flood that was a destruction to all of the people that willfully turned against God was the means of salvation for Noah and his family. One of the things that is interesting here is that we see this Noah finding favor in the eyes of the Lord. He was consistent before his peers the entire time that he was preaching while he was working on his ark. And if he wasn't out and out teaching just the object lesson of the ark there, had to be mean much to the people that were surrounding this. And so we see that Noah's family was saved as a result of the ark and the flood which came. Not only was Noah's family saved, but we also see that one pair of all of the land animals and the birds, of all of the species of land animals and birds, were also saved. And then seven pair of clean animals were saved. Now, the one pair of land animals and the birds that were saved were so that they could perpetuate the species after the flood. The seven pair of clean animals would have probably been because, one, they needed to perform sacrifices after they came off the ark. So they had to have some animals for that. They probably also needed some of these clean animals, which would have been the domesticated animals. They needed these after the flood to begin life again. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought about what the world would have looked like after the flood. When Noah disembarked from the ark, there was utter chaos as far as the nature was concerned. There was probably barren wilderness, maybe just a few snags of trees and so on that had been tumbled about during the time of the flood. But they needed something to live off of for a while before the crops would start to grow again. And so this is probably one of the reasons for the seven pair of clean animals, along with the need to make the sacrifices. So now we also have the time of the flood. When did this great flood occur? And for the present time, I am assuming that this is a worldwide flood. We will come back and address that in just a little bit about some of the reasons why I think that this was a worldwide flood. First off, it tells us that Noah was 600 years old. This is in Genesis chapter 7 and verse 6. Noah was 600 years old when the flood waters came on the earth. So he was 600 years old at the time of the flood, and we don't know exactly when that was. Now, if you believe that the earth is 6,013 years old, going back to 4004 BC as being the beginning of the earth, then the flood would have been about 4,000 years ago. It would have been about 2,000 years after Adam and Eve, somewhere between 1,600 and 2,000 years after Adam and Eve. Now, as I said this morning, I really think that the earth is somewhat older than 6,000 years. I don't think that the earth is any older than 10,000 years. You can't push me that far. But I think that is somewhat older than 6,000 years. So that would say that the flood would be somewhere around 4,000 B.C. Again, the Bible doesn't tell us. I don't think that it's real critical that we know when it occurred. It's just important that we know that it did occur. Now, what was the size of the ark? Let's talk about the ark itself just a little bit. First off, we see that the ark is the same word that when it talks about the ark, This is the same word that's used for the basket that Moses was kept in when his mother had to hide him from the Pharaoh. And the basket that she put into the river, and Moses' sister took care of there, the same word is used for that basket as is used for the ark. So once again, not only does this illustrate the idea of a big boat, but this illustrates the idea of something for protection, something for salvation. This basket was the salvation for Moses. This is how he was able to survive until Pharaoh's daughter was able to find him and bring him into the palace. Now, the ark itself was a very large boat. Some of you have boats. You know something about boats and so on. And it talks about this, and I put the numbers into our units of measurement. The Bible gives them in cubits. And this is, most Bible scholars believe that this is fairly accurate. Now, 450 feet long, that is the length of 1.5 football fields. So that's a pretty good-sized boat. Now, some of you have gone on cruises, and you've probably been on a boat that's been about 1,000 feet long or so on, so it wouldn't have been that big. But then also, the ark was 45 feet high, 75 feet wide. Now, 75 feet wide, 450 feet long, this was not a boat that you would have wanted to water ski behind. This does not a speed boat. This boat was built for two purposes. One, it was built to carry cargo, and second, it was built to withstand stormy seas. And boat builders even now say that these dimensions that we have are just about ideal for a barge type of structure. Now, when we're talking about this, this reminds me a little bit of the story of where the two boys were deciding to have a little fun with the pastor, and they were doing some mischief, and they decided to glue two pages of the pulpit Bible together. And so they glued two pages together. And so the pastor is reading the scriptures in the morning. And he said, "And now Noah took unto him a wife, and the dimensions of her were 150 cubits long," and so on. Well, anyway, that was the boat that was that size, not Noah's wife. So we see the size of the boat. Now, we also see that there are some other features to this. One is that it was three stories high. The top, there was only one door to the boat, one door to the outside. And again, this gives us this illustration of salvation. There is only one way of salvation, and this is through Jesus Christ our Lord. I know that there are many people out there that like to say that there are many ways that we can all reach heaven. No, the Bible tells us that there was only one way of salvation. There was only one way into this ark. One preacher I heard one time said that if they ever find the ark, you're going to find scratch marks all over there from where people were clawing, trying to find their way in once the rain started to come and once the water started to come on up. Now, I don't think we're ever going to find the ark. We'll speak about that just a little bit later. But again, there's only one way. And when God shut the door, it wasn't Noah that shut the door. God shut the door. There was an opening for light, and this opening was probably all the way around the outside. This is a model that someone has made of the ark. This is about a third size model. This door is just to go out on the deck to get some sun. Not probably too likely, at least at the beginning of the flood. But here we have one floor, two floors, and three floors on this. We have another model of this. This is a Dutch model, and this model is pretty much to scale. The door going on in is over here, and then you have one story, two story, and the third story up here with an area for light going all the way around. another view of the same boat and receive the same thing, that there are the two floors that are in that main portion and then the top floor up there. Now, we see that there are many people that have gone out onto Mount Ararat and they have tried to find the ark. There are people out there almost all of the time that are looking for the ark. About 30 years ago, there was a real big push to go and find the ark. And many of the creation organizations were going out and feeling that this would be one of the greatest evangelistic tools that we could think of if somebody could find the ark. I personally don't think they're ever going to find the ark. And if we do find the ark, it is not going to be any more of an evangelistic tool than what we have right here. This is the only evangelistic tool that we need, because we have the rich man and Lazarus. And what did they say? Even if they won't listen to Moses and the prophets, they won't listen to somebody coming back from the dead. And if they won't listen to the scriptures, they won't listen to someone coming from the with pieces of the ark. Now, you say, where is the ark there? Well, this is supposed to be remnants of the ark here. This is on Mount Ararat, and so that is supposed to be the sides of the ark. I've got several pictures that show the same thing. Here again, we see the outline like this. That's supposed to be the outline of the ark. Now, I've also, I do have a degree in biology, but I've also studied a considerable amount of geology. I told you this morning that I've led tours into the Grand Canyon, Zion Canyon, Bryce Canyon, places like this. When I teach on the Ariba program, I teach science there, and we go on up into the Andes, and we look at all kinds of glacial features and lava features and things like this. These are simply what are called lava dikes. And so I don't think that there's any remnant of the ark there. It's not petrified wood or anything like that. See, here we have lava dikes up here also that are sticking on up. These are the same thing, just a little bit lower. There's some more of them in there. And you see the same thing when you go to the Black Hills. You go to the Black Hills, you have the various areas where you've got the pinnacles sticking on up. These are all lava intrusions. Another picture of the same thing here. We see what's supposed to be the ark. And then this one is a picture of a different place. And somebody thinks that this is the ark. And once again, we have this area here. It's on Mount Ararat, but someone thinks that that would be the ark. You say, well, why don't they go over there and, you know, dig on this? Well, first off, many of these pictures have been taken by satellite or have been taken from planes. It's not quite that easy to get there. When they have gotten there, basically they've found rock. Okay, this is another one. This is a satellite picture that someone said is conclusive evidence that the ark is on the mountain. And so the conclusive evidence is this spot and this spot. And that's supposed to be the front and the back. And I don't know which is which on that. I'm having a hard time deciding that. And then those arrows are pointing to the sides of the ark once again. And so actually much of the evidence of the ark on the mountain is somewhat suspect. And as I said, personally, I don't think that they're ever going to find it. God doesn't need it, but it probably would be interesting. If somebody would ask me, would you like to go on an expedition there? If I knew the Kurds weren't going to shoot at me, sure, I would go. But anyway, just because I like to climb mountains and explore things. So anyway, the ark, we see that they're still looking at. We know that it landed on Mount Ararat. Then the size of the ark, continuing on. Now, was this ark large enough to do what it was supposed to do? Remember, we need to have one pair of every species of land animals and birds. We don't need any fish on the ark. There were no aquariums on the ark. There was plenty of water for the fish. So we have the land animals and the birds that we have here. Now, Whitcomb and Morris, in their book, The Genesis Flood, have done a lot of calculation on this. And they say that the size of the ark, it had the cubic feet of 522 railroad cars, railroad stock cars. Now, I grew up in ranching country, and we shipped our cattle by railroad cars quite often. And so, you know, if you have never seen a railroad stock car, it's about the same size as every other railroad car that you see, just maybe a little bit taller. A competent taxonomist has told us that we need that there would be about 17,500 species of animals that would have to be taken on the ark. Now, that's 35,000 animals. Now, remember, we do not need to take the fish there. We do not need to take any of the other water creatures there. Now, of these 17,500 species of animals, what constitutes a species? Now, this is one of those things that's a problem. See, did God put every variety of dog on the ark? Okay, were there St. Bernards and Dachshunds and poodles? No, God would not have put poodles on the ark. But anyway, and now we know that they are all members of the same species. They're all part of the species Canis familiaris. But now, would God have had to put a pair of dogs and a pair of coyotes and a pair of wolves on the ark? No, I don't think so. I believe that God put a pair of dog-like animals on the ark, and all the rest of the varieties that we have come about since that time. Now, this is not evolution. This is just God allows for certain changes to take place from generation to generation. If you take a look at your father or your mother, you probably do not look exactly like them. If you take a look at their children, they do not look exactly like you. There's differences. And so there are going to be differences from generation to generation. But God allows how far these differences are going to go. They are not going to extend indefinitely that we can go, as Duane Gish says, from fish to gish. We will not go from a fish to a human. You can't go that far. But we could go with a dog, pair of dog-like animals, wolf-like animals, and I think that we could get all of the different kinds of animals that we have. Now, they've done this with cattle. They've bred cattle for different purposes, for milk, for meat, riding in rodeos, all types of things. To horses, again, you have many different varieties of horses that have been bred. So when we're talking about the 17,000 species of animals, that is, I think, a fairly good number. Now, how big would these animals have been? When you speak about animals on the ark, most people, the first thing that they think of are dinosaurs. And they think that all the animals had to be the size of a dinosaur. No, they didn't have to be that big. Now, again, Whitcomb and Morris say that the average size of an animal would be about that of a sheep. And so you would have some that were bigger, many of them that would be smaller. And so if you would say that the average size of the animal was that of a sheep, are we able to put this on there? 522 boxcars can carry 125,000 sheep. So you see that we have more than three times as much space on this ark is what we would need to carry all of the different species of animals that would need to be transported from before the flood to after the flood. So the ark definitely was large enough. Now, the arrangement of the ark, and I've taken much of this from a book called Noah's Ark, A Feasibility Prospect, by a man by the name of John Woodmorappy. John Woodnorappy is an interesting individual. He has Tourette syndrome, and he is also autistic. Socially, he would never make a good salesman. But God has given him this ability of being able to absolutely, totally concentrate on an area of study. And he has done total study on the ark and has come up with some amazing things as far as, would the ark be big enough and would this be possible to carry these animals on the ark for a certain length of time? And he has said that probably the bottom floor was for the animals. The second floor would probably have been for the food. Now, I don't know if you've ever thought of this, but if you have 8 people and they now have to take care of 35,000 animals, how are they going to do this? First off, if they're all mice, it wouldn't be that big of a deal. But they weren't all mice. There were all these other types of animals. How would this take place? Well, if you would have some type of system in which they would have self-feeders, if you would have the top floor or one of the floors for the feed and the animals would be down below, all of you that have ever pitched hay out of a haymow to the cattle down below know how this works. And so they would have been able to do something like this. Also, that many of these animals probably went into some type of a hibernation stage. Animals hibernate or estivate. Hibernation means that they sleep because it's too cold. Estivate means that they sleep because it's too hot. And so these animals could have done the same thing, and during hibernation or estivation, they don't need to have feed. So he illustrates this, that with one floor for the food, and for those animals that did need food periodically, it wouldn't be impossible to feed those. And then the one floor, most probably the top floor, would have been the floor for the humans, and there would have been ample room for them. Then we also see that it tells us that the ark was made out of gopher wood. Now, if I ask you to go to the lumber yard and buy gopher wood, you probably wouldn't know what to get me. So what was gopher wood? Well, we don't know for sure, but we do know that Solomon built the temple out from much of the wood that he used was the cedars of Lebanon. And so we know that cedars or cypress trees were common in that time. What do we also know about cedar and cypress? One of the things is that it, especially cypress, once it swells up, it's tight and it doesn't leak. You know, all of those water tanks that they have that you see on How the West Was Won and all of the westerns, the water tanks that they used for filling the locomotives with water, those were all made out of cypress. And cypress swells up, it doesn't rot with water, and it's tight. Those things were tight and very good wood. So we probably had some type of a cedar or cypress. Then it was also pitched. It says that the ark was pitched. And this would have kept it watertight. Now, this is an interesting story. We know that Moses' ark, his basket, was also pitched within and without to keep that watertight. Some of you have probably read the story of Thor Heyerdahl, who tried to find out whether it was possible for people to go from Europe or Africa by some type of a sailing vessel with primitive vessel across to North America. And so he basically just used reeds and things of this nature and built this ship and tried to come across. He was never able to make it until he read Genesis. And when he read Genesis, he realized that they pitched these vessels within and without, and so he took tar from some of the sands of Egypt, and he covered his boat with this, and he was then able to sail all the way across. And so God knew what it needed to keep that ark afloat for a year. Now, how long did the flood take place? Well, first off, we know, and this isn't part of the flood, but it tells us in Genesis chapter 6, verse 3, that the Lord said, "My spirit will not contend with man forever." This is after he's seen the wickedness there. "For he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. And so this is the length of time that Noah spent building the ark. And so man had 120 years of grace that they could have repented. Then it says, in the 600th year, the second month, the 10th day, Noah entered the ark. This is given to us in Genesis 7, 4, 10, and 11. It tells us when Noah entered the ark, after he had finished building it. Then we see that there were 7 days more of grace. In verse 4, 7 days from now I will send rain on the earth for 40 days and 40 nights, and I'll wipe from the face of the earth every living creature. And on verse 11, in the 600th year of Noah's life, on the 17th day of the second month, on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth. Now, if man would have repented, what would God have done? If man would have repented in these 7 days. See, God had closed the ark. He had closed the door. And I think that he would have allowed those people into the ark. I can't say for sure, but God knew that they weren't. But he gave them the chance. There was 7 days of grace that man had. Then we see that there were 150 days of water, including 40 days of rain. I think that if I would have asked many of you, I said, how long was the flood? Some of you would have said 40 days and 40 nights. No, the flood was longer than 40 days and 40 nights. It was 40 days and 40 nights of rain. Okay, the waters came down and came up for 150 years. In verse 11, the one I just read, it says that on that day all the springs of the great deep burst forth and the floodgates of the heavens were opened. So this water was not just rain, but it came down from the top. It also came up from the bottom. And the rest of these verses also give us this indication that we had this tremendous downpour, plus we also had the rain or the water coming on up. Now, this is the downpour, the heavens opening up. Now, if it would rain today, and all of the water that's in the atmosphere would come down on the earth today, how much water would there be? Well, I've seen various figures. I've seen figures from all of the water would cover the earth from 1/4 inch to 4 inches. Okay, that's all the water that is in all of the clouds that are over the earth at any one time. Now, 4 inches of water doesn't make a good 40-day rain. All right, so there had to be more water in the atmosphere before this time. That was the canopy that I alluded to, the firmament that God created on the second day. And so we had a tremendous amount of water up there in that firmament that I said probably also evened out the temperatures. Those of you that have been in a greenhouse, you know that in a greenhouse, the temperature is probably pretty much the same wherever you go, even though the sun is shining in on one side. Okay, we have a canopy over this. You have this same effect with the earth, I believe, at that time. But not only did we have the water coming on down, we have the fountains of the deep. This is an example of a volcano. So we have the volcano there, and we have the fire and the lava. But what is this? This is steam. What is steam made up of? It's made up of water. Here we have an example of, this is a picture of Mount St. Helens, when Mount St. Helens blew up. Okay, there's a lot of ash in here, but there's also a tremendous amount of steam. Not only were people killed by the explosion that occurred, but people were killed from the floodwaters that came out of this. And the rivers coming down off of the mountain were flooded for about a week and a half, and overflowing their banks, and tremendous amount of destruction. Now, when you go through the Rocky Mountains, the Andes Mountains, all of these areas, there are a tremendous number of old volcanoes. Now, I think that those volcanoes, many of those, were part of the flood. When it says the windows or the fountains of the deep opened up, you had all of these volcanoes that were going off pretty much at one time. And so you would have a tremendous amount of water that would be released onto the earth at this time. So we have the 150 days of water, including 40 days of rain. Then we have on the 600th year, the seventh month, seventh day, the waters began to recede. This is in Genesis chapter 8, verse 1. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were in the ark. And here's another thing that I think is very interesting. The word remembered here is the same word that Christ used when he spoke to the thief on the cross. When Christ spoke to the thief on the cross, he said, I will remember you this day in paradise. And so that is that same word, that word of salvation that we have, that God remembered Noah. So we see the time here that the waters began to recede at this time. Then on the 600th year, the seventh month, the 17th day of the month, the ark rested on Mount Ararat. Now, where did the waters go? We know that there were probably enough water on the earth to cover all of the mountains to a depth so that the ark would not founder. The ark would not drag on this. So you had to have at least 15 to 20 feet of water over the highest mountains. Now, this water had to go someplace. Now, did this water all go back into the atmosphere? Let's just say that there was 15 feet of water over the highest mountains during the height of the flood. Now, this water, if it all went back into the atmosphere, we would now have enough water in the atmosphere to give us 15 feet of rain. Meteorologists tell us we don't have that. We have enough water in the atmosphere to give us 4 inches of rain. So the water didn't all go back into the atmosphere. Well, there are some explanations for this. One is that some of it did go back into the atmosphere. There was evaporation that did occur. And so the water would have gone back up. But as I said, that wouldn't be a sufficient explanation to give us all of it. But we would also have water that would have gone into the glaciers. Now, what would have caused glaciation to occur? If you are a Boy Scout, or if you want to know what direction the wind is coming from, what is the time-honored method of determining which direction the wind is coming from? You wet your finger, and you hold it on up, and what happens? One side of it gets cool. Why does it get cool? Because the water is evaporating from your finger. What does that water need to evaporate? It needs heat. Where does it get the heat from? From your finger. And so you're actually taking heat from your finger to evaporate that water. Now, the same thing would have happened on the earth. As the water was evaporating, it would have taken heat from the earth, and as it took heat from the earth, we would have had global cooling, not global warming, but global cooling would have taken place, and this would now have built up the glaciers. And so we see that we would have evaporation, we would also have glaciation, the formation of ice. We still have a lot of ice in the Antarctica, there's a lot of ice in Greenland, and this is all ice which is above the oceans. Another thing that we would see is that the water would have also gone into the oceans. I'll take you to Psalm 104. And in Psalm 104, which is a flood psalm, Psalm 104, verses 7 and 8, and this is one place, and it says, But at your rebuke, the waters fled. At the sound of your thunder, they took to flight. They flowed over the mountains. They went down into the valleys to the place you assigned for them. Now, I'm reading from the NIV. That's not a very good translation. The King James is not a very good translation on this verse. The NASB, the NASB, is by far the best translation on this particular verse. And what it says is that the mountains go up and the valleys go down. At the close of the flood, as the earth was equilibrating again, God placed his hand on the earth and now pushed down the valleys in some places, according to the psalmist. And as he pushed these valleys down, the mountains oozed on up. And so I think that we had the continents that were being reformed. Was Mount Everest present before the flood? No. Mount Everest was underwater before the flood because we find fossils on Mount Everest. But Mount Everest pushed on up after the flood and brought up some of these rock layers that have these fossils on them. And in fact, Mount Everest is still growing today. It is still rising. If you want to climb Mount Everest, you wait 10 years, you're going to have to climb higher. It'll probably be another 2-3 inches higher than it is now. And so these geological features are still changing. If you don't think that geological features are changing, live in California for a while. Oh, this last summer, I had one of those things. You know, there's 100 things to do before you die. All right. And one of those things was to survive an earthquake. All right. I was able to do that this last summer. We had an earthquake when I was down in Peru. I was so excited about it. So anyway, all of a sudden that night, it was just this rumble. I heard this sound, and my bed was just kind of shaking. And the next morning, I'm thinking, did I dream that, or was that actually the case? And so I asked some of my students. I said, was there an earthquake last night? Oh, yeah. I said, the things were shaking around pretty good. So anyway, I did survive an earthquake. But anyway, with this, with the God pushing down the mountains, or pushing down the earth, this is going to bring mountains up, and it's going to plow places where the water is going to be able to flow. Isaiah speaks about this also, and Isaiah chapter 40, verses 12 and 13, it tells us, who has measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, or with the breath of his hand marked off the heavens? Who has held the dust of the earth in a basket, or weighed the mountains on the scales and the hills in a balance? The idea that he was weighing these out, and he was pushing these up and down so that the water would run off, so that there would be dry land for man and land animals again, and there'd be a place for the water to go. And so God was able to take care of this water. Then we see that in the 600th year, the 10th day, first day of the month, mountains were visible. It continued to dry off. In the 11th month, the 10th day, the raven and the dove released. The dove returned. The raven had plenty of food. The raven is a carrion eater. If you've traveled out west, you know wherever there's roadkill, there are ravens. All right, and that is because they are carrion eaters. And so they had a feast. But the dove, they like vegetation. So there was nothing for the dove. Then we see that 7 days later, the dove returned and it brought back a leaf. And then we have 7 days after that, the dove stayed away because it now had a place where it could rest. See, a dove doesn't need a fancy place to rest. They just need some vegetation. If any of you have ever seen a dove nest, you know that they don't need a lot there. Three sticks in a crotch of a tree, and they're fine. All right, they don't have to have something like an oriole does, or a barn swallow, or so on. So they didn't need much, but they do have to have some vegetation. Then we see in the 601st year, the first month, the first day, the earth dried, as we see in the 13th verse. And then we have that they disembarked on the 601st year, second month, 27th day, which was 370 days total. So Noah and his family were on the ark for 370 days, 5 days longer than a year. Now, what was the significance of the flood? And I need to cruise through this in a hurry here. One of the things is that the significance of the flood is that it was salvation. I already remembered that God remembered Noah. We also see in Luke chapter 22, it speaks about this. Another thing is that when the flood occurred, this was not a peaceful rain with the water receding. The word that we have in verse 1, it says, he sent a wind over the earth and the waters receded. The word receded there means with a turmoil, that the water was sloshing back and forth and it was spilling on up. It was a tsunami type of thing. Now, remember here about 3 years ago when they had the tsunami over in the Southeast Asia on the shores of India, one of my students was on the beach in Africa, and she said she was looking at the water, And all of a sudden, the swimmers were on dry ground. Well, at least there was no water there. And so she decided, this does not look good, and decided to head up the hill just a little ways. And said the water went on out, and then all of a sudden it came back in again. And it came all the way up. And where she was at, everyone realized that something was going on, and they were all able to get to safety. But this is the type of thing that was occurring with the flood. This wind, again, is not a gentle breeze. This is a turmoil that is occurring here. So we see that God remembered Noah and caused the tsunami to dry up the water. But it receded steadily. It kept on going back. We have several verses there that speak about this. And I want to turn to the verses in Job about this. Job is the oldest book in the Bible, the oldest book as far as when it was written. And I think that Job was lived fairly shortly after the flood. And in Job chapter 36, verses 27 and 28, it says, "He draws up the drops of water which distill as rain to the streams. The clouds pour down their moisture, and abundant showers fall on mankind." And so I think that Job is seeing some of these things that is happening after the flood. Verse 37 in chapter 37, verse 11. "He loads the clouds with moisture. He scatters his lightning through them." And so we see that that Job is probably living through the tail end of some of the effects of the flood. Now, another thing that I don't have time to go into, and when I have a message on Job also, and the things about Job, is that he sees mountains that are disappearing. I think Job was living during the time of continental drift. I think that the continents broke apart during the flood and started moving out, but that's another whole sermon. All right. Then we see the extent of the flood. I said that I was going to get back to this. How do we know that it was a worldwide flood? Well, the reason that I think it was a worldwide flood was, first off, that Noah had to enter the ark to be saved. If it would not have been a worldwide flood, it would have been much more convenient for God to just move Noah. He could have moved Noah to a high place and let the rest of the world be destroyed and so on. But since God had to form the ark, I think that that's a good reason to say that it was a worldwide flood. The size of the ark. Once again, if they just needed a boat to go across to the other side of this regional flood, they wouldn't have had to have an ark that would have been able to carry all of these animals, because many of these animals would have been on other parts of the world. They wouldn't have all had to be on the ark. Now, I have a list of about 115 reasons why it's a worldwide flood. I've distilled this down considerably. Another thing is that all the mountains were covered. The Bible tells us that all the mountains were covered. If you're going to have all the mountains in the world covered, it's difficult to do this with a regional flood. All right, just think about how water seeks its own level. Some of those things you learned in science. Okay, another thing is that Peter believed that it was a worldwide flood. I already read the reference in 2 Peter chapter 3, where it says that the whole world and everything on it was destroyed except for the individuals that were on the ark. So Peter believed it. And also, Jesus believed it. Because in Matthew chapter 24, and again I read this verse, what did he say? "As in the days of Noah, so is destruction of man going to be in the future time, although it's going to be by fire." And so God, or Jesus, believed that this flood was a worldwide flood. Now, there are also geological proofs of worldwide flood. If we look at geology, and again, we talked about it this morning, Romans chapter 1, Genesis talks about the glories of creation point us to God. Okay, we have sedimentary rocks. Now, Pastor just mentioned, as you were going through and building the church, you had all the limestone. There's a lot of limestone in this area. Now, that's probably a layer of limestone. This is limestone on top. The rest of these are sandstone. Okay, now how do these layers get put in like this? They get put this way either by wind or by water. You have to have one of those two methods to lay these down. These were put down by water, and we can tell this by the way the grains are smoothed off and polished. Water-laying grains will be different than our wind-laying grains. And so we have sedimentary rock, and sedimentary rock is worldwide. We find this all over, that you'll have sedimentary rock. And what method would there be other than a flood? Okay, another thing is that we have seashells and fish that are found in high mountains. This is a piece of shale. This is a piece of shale that has the fish fossil in it, and then there's a clam fossil in there. Okay, this comes from the mountains of Colorado. This came from about 5,000 feet. And so how did that fish get in there? Well, because of the worldwide flood. Another clam that we see there. Now, when do fossils take place? Are fossils taking place? Are they forming on a regular basis today? I grew up on a ranch. We had sheep. And sheep die whenever they feel like it. All right? You don't have to get a vet for them. They will just die. So if they're going to die, let them die. And, when we hauled many sheep out to the rock pile, and we put them out there on the rock pile, none of them ever fossilized. They were all eaten up by the coyotes. Okay? And so if you're going to have fossils, one of the things that you have to have is that you have to have sudden burial. You have to have sudden burial for fossils to be produced. Another thing is that not only, and this here, the actual original material has been replaced by rock. Okay, that's called permineralization. You not only have to have sudden burial, but you also have to have highly charged water that will now come on in and replace the minerals that were there. All right? And that's not happening today. We don't even the 10-inch rain that you had around this area here a year and a half ago wasn't enough water and wasn't highly charged enough to cause permineralization to occur. And so you have this. So you have to have the sudden burial, then you have to have this water that comes on through, and there's really no place where this could have occurred as efficiently as at the flood. Now, you can form fossils today. I have a friend of mine who's one of my students who's up in Canada, and he actually forms fossils. You send him something, and he will put this into a hot water stream that is charged with minerals, and in about 2 weeks, he'll have fossils. Now, see, the geologists tell us that this takes thousands of years, millions of years, for fossils to take place. You can get a pretty good fossil in 6 months. And so we didn't need to have millions of years, but the 370 days of the flood was probably ample enough to give us fossils. Another thing is that we have these massive lava intrusions. Here is a picture of Kilauea, and it doesn't show up real well, mountain over in Hawaii. If you've ever been to Hawaii, what is Hawaii? All of Hawaii is just lava. It's just big volcanoes. Now, there are new ones that are forming. There's going to be another Hawaiian island coming on up. It's south of the Big Island right now, but it's still about 5,000 feet below the ocean. And so if you're going to wait to go on that for your honeymoon, you're going to have to wait a little while. But anyway, we have all of these lava intrusions, probably part of the flood and the fountains of the deep that were opening up. We also have coal formations. When was coal formed? Now, coal was formed from basically plant material. We see the fossils in there. You see the plants in there, the leaves and so on. Coal formation was also probably formed during the time of the flood. This is a mine at Black Hills Power and Light out in Gillette, Wyoming. Here, this is a person. I know they don't show up very well. So we have approximately 20 feet of coal like this. Then there's some overburden over here. There's another 50 feet of coal below this individual. Now, how did this form? Did this form by plants just decaying in a swamp and through years and years and years of accumulation? No. Plants rot in that formation. But you had to have massive floats of plant material that were brought on in, then covered up. When I was talking about this turbulence that was occurring, we now have water that brings in this soil, covers this up, puts pressure on it, and coal formation can occur. University of Pennsylvania showed that with proper laboratory conditions, you can form coal in 6 months. So again, we don't need to have coal being formed over millions of years. Oil formations. Oil is probably formed from animal fats. And again, we see that there's oil all over the world, many places, except on my dad's land, so I have to work for a living. But anyway, we have oil that was formed, and again, probably formed as a result of the flood. So those are some of the geological reasons that show that there was a worldwide flood. Now, what was the purpose for the flood, the significance of the flood? It was for judgment for sin. And individuals that are willfully ignorant of this are going to have to suffer the consequences. Now, God has also told us in Genesis 8, verse 21, that He is never again going to destroy the earth with this water. And this is another reason that I could say that the worldwide flood was a once-in-a-lifetime or once-in-a-world-time flood, because there have been some massive floods since that time. But no flood like the Noachian flood. Then we see that God says that He is never going to curse the ground again with after the flood. There's going to be limited uniformity established. I think that we had a situation before the flood that there was uniformity, that the seasons and so on were very regular. The flood destroyed all of this. But now we have, you know, you predict, some of you are starting to look through the seed catalogs already, the flower catalogs, and trying to decide what you're going to plant in your garden. You know that the time is going to come, somewhere close to the 4th of July, when you can start planting your stuff in the garden again. But see, we have this uniformity that we have. This, and God says that that's going to be established. And then we see that there is the promise, however, that this flood, this judgment, is never going to occur again. And that is the rainbow that God has given us, and that is the promise that we are not going to suffer from this. But, as 2 Peter said, don't be slothful. There will be a judgment for sin. Sin must be punished. And the next time, the world is going to be destroyed as by fire. And every man will have to account for what he has done with Christ and with the knowledge that God has given at that time. Thank you.